Golgotha. Lieutenant Ninomaya reaches Boondock about 2 weeks after Goto Dango, accompanied by several bashed and scraped wooden cases.
"What is your specialty?"
asks Goto Dango, and Lieutenant Ninomaya responds by opening up one of the cases to reveal a surveyor's transit swaddled in clean oiled linen. Another case contains an equally perfect sextant. Goto Dango gawks. The gleaming perfection of the instruments is a marvel, but even more marvelous is that they sent him a surveyor only 12 days after he requested one. Ninomaya grins at the look on his new colleague's face, revealing that he has lost all of his front teeth except for one, which happens to be mostly gold. Before any engineering can be done, all of this wilderness must be brought into the realm of the known. Detailed maps must be prepared, watersheds charted, soil sampled. For 2 weeks, Goto Dango has been going around with a pipe and a sledgehammer taking core samples of the dirt. He has identified rocks from the stream beds, estimated the flow rates of the Yamamoto and Tojo rivers, counted and cataloged trees. He has trudged through the jungle and planted flags around the approximate boundaries of the special security zone. The whole time, he's been worrying about having to perform the survey himself, using primitive, improvised tools. And all of a sudden, here is Lieutenant Ninomaya with his instruments. The three lieutenants, Goto, Mori, and Ninomaya, spend a few days surveying the flat, semi-open land straddling the lower Tojo River. The year, 1944, is turning out to be dry so far, and Mori does not want to construct his military barracks on land that will turn into a marsh after the first big rain. He is not concerned about the comfort of the prisoners, but he would at least like to ensure that they won't get washed away. The lay of the land is also important in setting up the interlocking fields of fire that will be necessary to put down any riots or mass escape attempts. They put Boondock's few enlisted men to work gathering bamboo stakes, then drive these in to mark the locations of roads, barracks, barbed wire fences, guard towers, and a few carefully sited mortar emplacements from which the guards will be able to fill the atmosphere in any chosen part of the camp with shrapnel. When Lieutenant Goto takes Lieutenant Ninomaya up into the jungle, clambering up the steep valley of the Tojo, Lieutenant Mori must stay behind, in accordance with Captain Noda's orders. This is just as well, since Mori has his work cut out for him down below. The captain has granted Ninomaya a special dispensation to see the special security zone.
"Elevations are of supreme importance in this project," Goto Dango tells the surveyor on the way up.
They are burdened with surveying equipment and fresh water, but Ninomaya clambers up the rocky gulch of the half-parched river just as ably as Goto Dango himself.
"We will begin by establishing the level of Lake Yamamoto, which does not exist yet, and then work downwards from there."
"I have also been ordered to obtain the precise latitude and longitude," says Ninomaya.
Goto Dango grins.
"That's hard. There is nowhere to see the sun."
"What about the three peaks?"
Goto Dango turns to see if Ninomaya is joking, but the surveyor is looking intently up the valley.
"Your dedication sets a good example," Goto Dango says.
"Ah, this place is paradise compared to Rabaul."
"Is that where you were sent from?"
"Yes."
"How did you escape? It is cut off, isn't it?"
"It has been cut off for some time," Ninomaya says curtly.
Then he adds,
"They came and got me in a submarine."
His voice is husky and faint. Goto Dango is silent for a while. Ninomaya has a system all worked out in his head, which they put into effect the next week, after they have done a rough survey of the special security zone. Early in the morning, they hoist an enlisted man into a tree with a canteen, a watch, and a mirror. There is nothing special about this tree except for a bamboo stake recently driven into the ground nearby, labeled Main Drift. Then Lieutenants Ninomaya and Goto climb to the top of the mountain, which takes them about 8 hours. It is dreadfully arduous, and Ninomaya is shocked that Goto volunteers to go with him.
"I want to see this place from the top of Calvary," Goto Dango explains. "Only then will I have the insight to perform my duty well."
On the way up, they compare notes. New Guinea versus New Britain. It seems that the latter's only saving grace is the settlement of Rabaul, a formerly British port complete with a cricket oval, now the linchpin of Nipponese forces in Southwest Asia.
"For a long time, it was a great place to be a surveyor," Ninomaya says,
and describes the fortifications that they built there in preparation for MacArthur's invasion. He has the draftsman's enthusiasm for detail, and at one point talks nonstop for an hour describing a particular system of bunkers and pillboxes, down to the last booby trap and glory hole. As the climb gets harder, the two vie with each other in belittling its difficulty. Goto Dango tells the tale of climbing over the snow-covered mountain range in New Guinea.
"Nowadays on New Britain, we climb volcanoes all the time,"
Ninomaya says offhandedly.
"Why?"
"To collect sulfur."
"Sulfur? Why?"
"To make gunpowder."
After this, they don't talk for a while. Goto Dango tries to dig them out of a conversational hole.
"It'll be a bad day for MacArthur when he tries to take Rabaul."
Ninomaya trudges along silently for a bit, trying to control himself, and fails.
"You idiot," he says. "Don't you see? MacArthur isn't coming. There's no need."
"But Rabaul is the cornerstone of the whole theater."
"It is a cornerstone of soft, sweet wood in a universe of termites,"
Ninomaya snaps.
"All he has to do is ignore us for another year, and then everyone will be dead of starvation or typhus."
The jungle thins out. The plants are wrestling for footholds on a loose slope of volcanic cinders, and only smaller ones endure. This puts Goto Dango in the mind of writing a poem in which the small, tenacious Nipponese prevail over the big, lumbering Americans. But it has been a long time since he wrote a poem, and he can't make the words go together. Someday the plants will turn this cone of scoria and rubble into soil, but not yet. Now that Goto Dango can finally see more than a few yards, he is beginning to understand the lay of the land. The numerical data that he and Ninomaya have compiled over the last week is being synthesized, within his mind, into a solid understanding of how this place works. Calvary is an old cinder cone. It started as a fissure from which ash and scoria were ejected, one fragment at a time, for thousands of years, tumbling up and outwards in a family of mortar-shell-like parabolic curves, varying in height and distance depending on the size of each fragment and the direction of the wind. They landed in a wide ring centered on the fissure. As the ring grew in height, it naturally spread out into a broad truncated cone with a central pit gouged out of its top, with the spitting fissure in the bottom of that pit. The winds here tend to come from a little bit east of due south, and so the ash tended to be pushed towards the north by northwest edge of the cone's rim. That is still the highest point of the cinder cone. But the fissure died out eons ago, or perhaps was plugged by its own emissions, and the whole structure has been much eroded since then. The southern rim of the cone is just a barrier of low hills perforated by the courses of the Yamamoto River and the two tributaries that come together to form the Tojo River. The central pit is a bowl of loathsome jungle, so saturated with chlorophyll that it looks black from above. Birds cruise above the canopy, looking like colored stars from up here. The northern rim still rises a good 500 meters above the bowl of jungle, but its formerly smooth arc has been dissected by erosion to form three distinct summits, each one a pile of rich scoria half concealed by a stubble of green vegetation. Without discussion, Ninomaya and Goto Dango head for the one in the middle, which is the highest. They reach it at about 2:30 in the afternoon and immediately wish they hadn't, because the sun is beating almost straight down on top of them. But there is a cool breeze up here, and once they have protected their heads with makeshift burnouses, it's not so bad. Goto Dango sets up the tripod and the transit, while Ninomaya uses his sextant to shoot the sun. He has a pretty good German watch, which he zeroed against the radio transmission from Manila this morning, and this enables him to reckon the longitude. He works the calculation out on a scrap of paper on his lap, then goes back and does it again to double-check the numbers, speaking them out loud. Godo Dango copies them down in his notebook, just in case Ninomaya's notes get lost. At 3 o'clock sharp, the enlisted man down in the tree begins to flash his mirror at them. A brilliant spark from a dark rug of jungle that is otherwise featureless. Ninomaya centers his transit on this signal and takes down more figures. In combination with various other data from maps, aerial photos, and the like, this should enable him to make an estimate of the main shaft's latitude and longitude.
"I don't know how accurate this will be," he frets, as they trudge down the mountain. "I have the peak exactly. What did you call it? Cavalry?"
"Close enough."
"This means soldiers on horseback, correct?"
"Yes."
"But the site of the shaft I will not have very precisely unless I can use better techniques."
Godo Dango considers telling him that this is perfectly all right, that the place was made to be lost and forgotten, but he keeps his mouth shut. The survey work takes another couple of weeks. They figure out where the shore of Lake Yamamoto will be and calculate its volume. It will be more of a pond than a lake, less than 100 meters across, but it will be deceptively deep, and it will hold a lot of water. They calculate the angle of the shaft that will connect the bottom of the lake to the main network of tunnels. They figure out where all of the horizontal tunnels will emerge from the walls of the Toja River's gorge and stake out the routes of roads and railways that will lead to those openings, so that debris can be removed and precious war material brought in for storage. They double and triple-check all of it to make sure that no fragment of the works will be visible from the air. Meanwhile, down below, Lieutenant Maury and a small work detail have planted some fence posts and strung some barbed wire, just enough to contain 100 or so prisoners who arrive packed into a couple of military trucks. When these are put to work, the camp expands very rapidly. The military barracks go up in a few days, and the double barbed wire perimeter is completed. They never seem to lack for supplies here. Dynamite comes in by the truckload, as if it weren't desperately needed in places like Rabaul, and is carefully stored under the supervision of Godo Dango. Prisoners carry it into a special shed that has been constructed for this purpose in the shade of the jungle. Godo Dango has not been close to the prisoners before and is startled to realize that they are all Chinese, and they are not speaking the dialect of Canton or Formosa, but rather one that Godo Dango heard frequently when he was posted in Shanghai. These prisoners are northern Chinese. It is stranger and stranger all the time, this boondock place. The Filipinos, he knows, have been uniquely surly about their inclusion in the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. They are well-armed, and MacArthur has been egging them on. Many thousands of them have been taken prisoner. Within half a day's drive of Boondock, there are more than enough Filipino prisoners to fill Lieutenant Maury's camp and accomplish Lieutenant Godo's project. And yet, the powers that be have shipped hundreds of Chinese people all the way down from Shanghai to do this work. At times like this, he begins to doubt his own sanity. He feels an urge to discuss the matter with Lieutenant Ninomaya, but the surveyor, his friend and confidant, has made himself scarce since his work was completed. One day, Godo Dango goes by Ninomaya's tent and finds it empty. Captain Noda explains that the surveyor was called away suddenly to perform important work elsewhere. About a month later, when the road-building work in the special security zone is well underway, some of the Chinese workers who are digging begin shouting excitedly. Godo Dango understands what they are saying. They have uncovered human remains. The jungle has done its work, and practically nothing is left but bones. But the smell and the legions of ants tell him that the corpse is a fairly recent one. He grabs a shovel from one of the workers and pulls up a scoop of dirt and carries it over to the river, dripping tangles of ants. He lowers it carefully into the running water. The dirt dissolves into a brown trail in the river, and the skull is soon revealed, the dome of the head, the eye sockets still not entirely empty, the nasal bone with some fragments of cartilage still attached, and finally the jaws, pocked with old abscesses and missing most of their teeth, except for one gold tooth in the middle. The current turns the skull over slowly, as if Lieutenant Ninomai is hiding his face in shame, and Goto Dengo sees a neat hole punched through the base of the skull. He looks up. A dozen Chinese are gathered above him on the riverbank, watching him impassively.
"Do not speak of this to any of the other Nipponese,"
Goto Dengo says. Their eyes go wide and their lips part in astonishment as they hear him speaking the precise dialect of Shanghai prostitutes. One of the Chinese workers is nearly bald. He seems to be in his 40s, though prisoners age rapidly, and so it is always difficult to tell. He is not scared like the others. He is looking at Goto Dengo appraisingly.
"You,"
Goto Dengo says,
"pick two other men and follow me. Bring shovels."
He leads them into the jungle, into a place where he knows there will be no further digging, and shows them where to put Lieutenant Ninomaya's new grave. The bald man is a good leader, as well as a strong worker, and he gets the grave dug quickly, then transfers the remains without squeamishness or complaint. If he has been through the China incident and survived for this long as a prisoner of war, he has probably seen and done much worse. Goto Dengo does his part by distracting Captain Noda for a couple of hours. They go up and tour the dam work on the Yamamoto River. Noda is anxious to create Lake Yamamoto as soon as possible, before MacArthur's Air Force makes detailed surveys of the area. The sudden appearance of a lake in the jungle would probably not go unnoticed. The site of the lake is a natural rock bowl covered by jungle, with the Yamamoto River running through the middle of it. Right next to the riverbank, men are already at work with rock drills, placing dynamite charges.
"The inclined shaft will start here," Goto Dengo tells Captain Noda. "And run straight."
Turning his back on the river, he makes one hand into a blade and thrusts it into the jungle.
"Straight down to Golgotha,
the place of the skull."
"Golgotha?"
Captain Noda says.
"It means hidden glade,"
Goto Dengo says authoritatively.
"Hidden glade. I like it. Very good. Golgotha,"
Captain Noda says.
"Your work is proceeding very well, Lieutenant Goto."
"I am only striving to live up to the high standard that was set by Lieutenant Ninomaya," says Goto Dengo.
"He was an excellent worker,"
Noda says evenly.
"Perhaps when I am finished here, I can follow him to wherever he was sent."
Noda grins.
"Your work is only beginning, but I can say with confidence that when you are finished, you will be reunited with your friend."